The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Joseph L. Toth presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. This is Judge Toth, and I'm joined by Judge Falvey and Judge Jaquith. We are convened today via video conference to consider arguments in the matter of Dixie R. Allison versus Douglas A. Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 23-4065. Will counsel, beginning with the appellant's counsel, please make your appearance for our record?
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Kenny Dohakis, joined by Alyssa Gilbert with Carpenter Chartered for the appellant.
Good morning, Mr. Dohakis.
Good morning, Your Honor. James Druckhammer appearing as counsel for the secretary, joined by Mark Vichich as co-counsel.
Good morning, Mr. Druckhammer. Would appellant's counsel like to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, we would like to reserve 8 minutes.
Okay, so noted. If counsel are ready, we'll begin with appellant's counsel. Mr. Dohakis.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. On behalf of Mrs. Allison, I want to thank this court for the opportunity to present her appeal. Mrs. Allison, a substituted claimant, is seeking additional compensation benefits owed her late husband. At the time of his death, he had a claim pending seeking a higher disability rating for his psychiatric condition to include a TDIU rating. This court has already held in a memorandum decision that the board violated 7104A when it considered the TDIU question in the first instance, and we ask this panel to reaffirm that ruling. The question here is whether there was any harm in that error. I want to start by reiterating that under Bernard's plain text interpretation of 7104A, the board has jurisdiction over all questions in a matter, but lacks authority to adjudicate any question that was not subject to initial decision by the AOJ. And in this case, the question in particular being the TDIU rating or entitlement to a TDIU rating is extremely fact heavy. And as we emphasized in our supplemental briefing, those questions, those factual questions have different review depending on whether the board is looking at it or the court. And so when the board looks at facts in the first instance, violating 7104A's requirement for one review on appeal, the only option available to the claimant is to come to this court and argue for clear error, which is a very high burden, as all who practice here know.
So, Mr. Hawkins, I want to ask you about the secretary's argument that the Bernard waiver kind of prejudice schema doesn't really apply to the AMA, because obviously, under the legacy system, there's a lot of evidentiary development happened after, and it wasn't always immediately clear to people what issues the board may kind of end up addressing on appeal. And then obviously there wasn't, if the board kind of adverse decision couldn't be challenged any longer within VA. I mean, you have to collaterally attack it later. So what do you say about that, that the sort of AMA kind of overhaul of a lot of the procedures has kind of put to rest a lot of the concerns that animated Bernard?
My first response, Your Honor, is that there's no indication in the AMA that Congress intended to modify or change 7104A. In fact, the language is exactly the same. And it makes sense that if Congress had wanted to make that change, it would have amended 7104A. Now, we acknowledge that there were significant changes, primarily what evidence is considered, and the application of the duty to assist. But none of those touches on whether the board is allowed to, under the plain text of 7104A, consider a factual question or any other question in a matter that the AOJ had not yet done. The language in 7104A is clear, and as Bernard interpreted it.
But you realize, I mean, that has the potential to be really unwieldy. I mean, are you saying every single factual matter that the RO has not addressed, they'd have to remand? I mean, it would just be like a ping pong game of endless remands. What would you say about that? I mean, I can't imagine that that's good, practically speaking, for veterans.
Well, again, Your Honor, it's that system, that procedure has been in place well before the AMA. When Congress initially looked at evidence, for instance, at the board, they were finding that the board was remanding evidence or remanding appeals because of new evidence, and they amended the statute that says the board is allowed to, I believe it was in 2012, that the board is allowed to, in the first instance, look at evidence unless the claimant says that they don't want that. That was the requirement for one review on appeal remained. And so the idea that just because the board can look at evidence in the first instance, that they're also allowed to circumvent one review on appeal doesn't hold water in light of that change in law. And with respect to the duty to assist, that really has nothing to do with whether the factual questions have been determined. Now, it of course can inform some of the facts, and development of evidence will certainly inform the adjudicator on what the fact is. But simply because the duty to assist no longer applies after the RO decision does not mean that that Congress intended for the board to take over the role of the AOJ. And we have to remember that the reason for this procedural protection, as indicated in Bernard and reaffirmed, I think, in multiple in this court's precedent afterwards, is that there's these procedural protections for the claimant. And I emphasize, particularly under the facts of this case, the most important two are, one, notice of a determination, letting the VA or letting the claimant know that the VA had made a finding of some fact or even a conclusion of law, with those adequate information, and two, the standard of review. And after the AMA, the VA amended its regulations to put in place what we all kind of already assumed, but they explicitly said in the regulations that the board performs a de novo review. That's 20.801. And so this de novo review is really important, particularly to factual questions. And I would just point out as well, so that's really the most important aspect of this right that's in 7104A is to have.
Oh, Mr. DeHakis, what about Section 7113's provision that the board shall consider in the first instance evidence submitted by the appellant at the board hearing and within 90 days thereafter? Doesn't that statutory scheme itself enable the board to address the appellant's TDIU contentions?
Well, it certainly, I don't know that statutory provision, Your Honor, really changes anything. As I mentioned, in 2012, Congress amended the statute to allow the board in the first instance to consider evidence with an option for the claimant to ask for a remand for a supplemental statement of the case on that evidence. So the idea that the board is going to consider evidence submitted to it in the first instance is nothing new and has been around at least for a decade or nearly a decade by the time the AMA came around. But again, that statute did not touch on the right to one review on appeal, in particular of factual questions. And the other aspect of this with notice is 5104 was heavily amended to give a more robust information to the claimants to include some of the things that were brought up in the opening brief. In law and determinations, and to some degree, you know, favorable findings, but without a decision by the or an adjudication by these questions within the matter, the claimant loses the ability to retain or obtain the 5104 notice that the AMA is really the driving force, the engine behind the AMA. And the board under Greer does not support or does not supply that 5104 notice. So when we get to the board with a question that has not been addressed by the AOJ, the veteran does not get notice under the statute and does not get the benefit of a de novo review, particularly of fact findings, and is now limited to essentially is limited to arguing for clear error, as Mrs. Allison has been.
How is that clear error? I mean, de novo review just means, you know, there's no deference to any earlier adjudication. Clear error means the board would be essentially saying, okay, I may disagree with that RO finding, but I cannot discern any error in it. Whereas the board just, I mean, de novo means they do it kind of tabula rasa, as if there were never any claim done before. How is it clear error?
Well, that's exactly, Your Honor. The board is not looking for clear error. The board is making a new determination. But again, it's a de novo review of any findings by the AOJ that, with the benefit of those findings, with the benefit of the 5104 robust notice under the AMA, the claimant has other options, so to speak. And this court's precedent in case law dealing with all of the AMA really emphasizes the choices that are available, and the real reason for the AMA is to allow for these choices. But all of them
since Ms. Allison specifically asked that a request for TDIU be considered part and parcel of the current appeal, how can she complain that the board did as she asked and decided the TDIU issue?
Your Honor, she asking for something that is already the law is not a request for a waiver of any rights. TDIU is always and has always been a question within the matter of the appropriate rating. And that goes back at least as far as Rice and even earlier. So just asking for something that she already has a right to have, which is that the board take jurisdiction of the TDIU rating, or at least consider as part of the rating a TDIU rating, is not and cannot be really interpreted as a waiver of any kind of right to one review on appeal. The law is quite clear that TDIU is just a rating, and it's no different than if she had requested any other scheduler rating. So all she was doing with that was simply alerting the board to the fact that the evidence also supports entitlement to a TDIU rating, and that she expected an adjudication from the secretary. And so, you know, in looking back at Comer and some of the other Federal Circuit precedent, TDIU, when raised either implicitly by the record or explicitly by the veteran, is part of a rating whenever it's raised, whenever the rating issue is presented to the board with an appeal. And so, again, requesting that they adjudicate it goes to the jurisdiction of the board, does not go to the authority that Bernard distinguished and that Jarrell also distinguished, although kind of obliquely, that once the matter is before the board, all questions to include the appropriate rating under any applicable law or potentially applicable law is within the jurisdiction of the board.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Hawkins. What would be the statutory or regulatory authority for the board to remand a case? Because obviously some veterans might object to the fact that, you know, it took them a long time for to get their claim in front of the board, and rather than adjudicating something, the board is remanding it. Now, I know under regulation they can remand if further development is needed, right? If they find that the duty assist hasn't been satisfied and something's needed. What you're describing is almost more like a referral, which is an inability to adjudicate something in the first instance. So you refer it to another party for an initial adjudication. So back to my question, what is the statutory or regulatory authority that would allow the board to adjudicate something that fell within the scope of a claim on appeal?
I want to make sure I understand your question, Your Honor, because you kind of said two things there. So the statutory authority, you're asking the statutory regulatory authority to remand
Because someone could just as easily challenge it from the other direction and say the board had a duty to adjudicate whatever, you know, you're saying some new facts, something that hasn't been addressed by the adjudicator. And I'm imagining a challenge where somebody says, well, what authority does the board have to in a sense, relinquish this and send it back to an RO? I wanted the board to adjudicate it. Meaning, you know, processes are governed by regulation. They're governed by statute. So
I believe the statutory authority, Your Honor, is 7104A. It doesn't explicitly give it doesn't explicitly tell the board to remand a question in the matter, but it's implicit and implied within its mandate that the question is subject to one review on appeal. And so when the specific question has not been addressed, the board has to recognize that it has no authority under 7104A, although it does have jurisdiction, and to remand the specific question for that initial one review on appeal. The secretary promulgated its regulations in identifying that remands for duty to assist errors were required, which is from the statute. There's no dispute in that. They also created this other regulation, a subsection that allows it to, it may remand for other reasons. We don't really rely upon that. I'm not really sure what that regulation means. And there's been some questions in various decisions from this court over the past couple of years on what that exactly means. But that part of the regulation, we don't rely upon, mostly because it requires a finding that it would result in a possible entitlement to benefits or something along those lines. But we do believe that 7104A, inherent within its restriction on the board's ability or authority to review questions that have not been subject to AOJ decision or adjudication, to inherently give it that authority to remand for that review.
The appellant supplemental brief appears to contend that fairness requires a waiver by the appellant for the board to address questions that the AOJ did not. If the argument is that the board denied the appellant fair process, please explain how that is so.
So, yes, thank you, Your Honor. So that's the other side of this, is that even though the board is normally not allowed to, certainly the claimant can ask it to specifically and waive that review. But simply raising the question is not the equivalent of waiving one review on appeal. And if the board has any question about whether the waiver, the submission or any communication was a waiver, we look at Bill Haars that reaffirms the board's hearing officer's obligations to fully explain the issues to the appellant. And when this was presented at the hearing, the board member could have simply just asked, are you waiving this? Do you understand what a waiver is? They didn't do that. And we would note too that the appellant was not represented by an attorney at the hearing. There was a representative, but it was not an attorney. And we know from this court and the Federal Circuit's precedent that we treat non-attorney represented claimants differently. But regardless, Bill Haars reaffirms the board's obligation with a hearing to fully explain these issues. Bernard and the general counsel opinion that Bernard discussed in there really emphasized the idea that the board has to reach out to the appellant when it's considering doing this and either make a determination that the veteran will not be harmed or ask the veteran if they want to waive it. There's nothing that stops the board from just reaching out with a letter and says, we're looking at this. We're looking at remanding this because of our restrictions. Do you want to wait? Do you want to have this remanded and have to wait for this to get back to the board, or do you waive this remand? Judge,
is there anything left factually for VA to address in this case? What would be accomplished if we remanded?
So a remand, Your Honor, if we look at the record on page 11 and 12, these are the very fact-heavy determinations that were done by the board that were never done by the AOJ. And these are specific to a TDIU rating. Now, in some instances, a lot of the same fact-finding will apply to different ratings. And so we don't really see this as an issue when the question is merely a scheduler rating, because a lot of the findings are gonna complement or apply to the various percentages that are underneath the diagnostic code. Where we see this in, most distinguished is in a TDIU, where we're looking at work history. We're looking at what skills and education and training the veteran had, what kinds of those are transferable to different jobs. And how does the individual disabilities affect not only on the average impairment as the diagnostic code contemplates, but specifically in getting in keeping a job, which is what's contemplated by 4.16. And so these kinds of questions are what make up the ultimate determination of whether a veteran is unemployable and entitled to a TDIU rating. And so, again, all of these questions should have been addressed by the AOJ in the first instance so that Mrs. Ellison could have received notice, could have received the de novo review by the board of those. And I think in all of our experience, we know that the more eyes that look at these, the better refined the issues become and a better decision that comes out, as opposed to the board looking at it without the benefit of the AOJ review and then having to argue for clear error at the court, which is a nearly impossible burden to overcome. So, and Judge Jakewood, to your question about fair process, which is, I think now we do process under Bill Haar's, there was no fair or due process here, because the process that was required was to receive and obtain an adjudication by the AOJ of all of these findings of fact, all of these questions in the rating matter from the AOJ, so that she can appeal them to the board, and that did not happen. And we really want to emphasize, and you know, we've said this quite a bit, and I'll keep repeating it, but the primary harm that Mrs. Ellison is suffering is that she's having to ask this court to overturn these findings of fact, which is not fair to her under that, and is really not the process that was promised by Congress in 7104A.
I ask you, Mr. Hawk, as I'm kind of sort of gaming this out in my head as to how this works, but so under 7113, obviously people are allowed to submit evidence to the board. And, you know, sometimes this happens, the evidence will suggest maybe a different theory of entitlement for a claim that's already on appeal. So something like, if you imagine somebody's got a depression claim, it was denied on a direct basis, and then they submit some evidence that suggests maybe it's secondary to something else, right? So a different theory, but fundamentally the same claim. How would that work under the scenario you're proposing? They would have to refer that to the RO, or remand it to the RO to address, because there's been no fact finding, even though it would be the same claim that's on appeal, and they're looking at the evidence they're allowed to look at under 7113. How would that work?
So that is the default, Your Honor. But I would just distinguish between a referral and a remand. I believe it was Young v. Shinseki. I hope I didn't misstate that precedent, but it distinguished between a remand in which the board does have jurisdiction and a referral in which it does not. And so the board in that instance would, by default, have to remand the question that you raised, where it was secondary to, or you know, some other way of finding that it was related to service.
However, a lot of our case, sorry to interrupt you, but like a lot of our case law is we sort of, you know, all this referral stuff was based on regulation. And so we often kind of described it as jurisdictional, because the secretary delegated, you know, some, you know, refer extra schedule or refer this. None of that's jurisdictional. So in a sense, I mean, they may violate their own regulations by not referring something. But to me, referral is the more, I say remand is a fine term. But effectively, what's happening is it's, you're passing something along, not because of an error, but just because you sort of lack the delegation to kind of hear in the first instance.
Well, under that definition of referral, then yes, John, I think that would be appropriate. But you know, we have to deal with what we have in precedent now, which is where the court has called referral something that they didn't have a jurisdiction over, and this is where something was raised, a CUE or some other entirely different issue, which I don't believe the AMA really contemplates for that anymore necessarily. But even though that's the default, again, the veteran can waive this review by the AOJ. You know, Carpenter Chartered does that on a routine basis. And I know a lot of other attorneys will ask the board, we don't want a remand, we just want a decision. And they can certainly do that because it is a claims processing rule. And I don't think there's any dispute that that can be waived. And the board can also go ahead and adjudicate it. In your hypothetical, Your Honor, if the board can grant it, there's no reason why they can't, because even though they may have violated it, Bernard recognizes that it's a harmless error because the full benefit was granted. That, of course, assumes that the actual full benefit was granted. And in the case of a service connection matter, then that would be a full grant. But certainly in some rating issues, there may be additional things, ancillary benefits and so on, that the board may have overlooked, which, you know, again, that the third option is for the board to just reach out to the veteran and say, do you want to waive this? I want to consider this, but I want to remand this back or refer it back for adjudication. But if you don't want me to, then we don't have to. We can certainly ask.
Unwieldy. I mean, how long do they have to wait for a response? I mean, because I imagine this kind of could introduce, I mean, anytime you introduce complexity into a high volume system, you know, you're going to get delay. And so that's kind of what I'm wrestling with in the back of my mind, obviously beyond just legally, practically, this would introduce quite a bit of complexity into the system.
It may, Your Honor, but I think that the secretary can certainly make a regulation that gives a reasonable amount of time and subject to, you know, any challenges at the courts on whether that is in fact reasonable. The VA has for years, you know, had pretty standard response time, 60, 90 days, 1 year. Obviously, I don't think a year is appropriate for this kind of a question. When cases come back from the court, they by default give 90 days to submit any additional argument. I don't think that a 90-day response time is out of the question. I would even suggest that maybe a 30 or 60-day time frame is probably reasonable in a lot of cases, subject to the specifics of the individual veteran. But it's not going to – I don't anticipate that it would cause such significant disruption in the process to simply reach out and say, do you want me to do this right now? And if not, then we can send it back. And the disruption that goes along with going to court and overturning these, or even sending it back to the AOJ for initial development, yes, the board gets that off their plate, but the secretary as an agency now has to deal with the questions should the board send it back. So I think that it's a reasonable rule that the board can simply just ask and should ask. And that's what Bernard says. Bernard very clearly says, and the VA's OGC opinion, by the way, you know, going back to the 90s, recognized that there's no reason why the board can't reach out to the claimant. The fair process doctrine talks specifically and looking at Simmons in particular, looking at harmless or prejudicial error, talks about this team kind of concept with the veteran and the VA. This is not an adversarial system. This is the VA and the veteran working hand in hand in tandem to do what they can under the laws to help the veteran prove these claims. And it certainly isn't helpful if the board takes over something without any indication to the veteran that they're going to do so, knowing that it's going to cut off a very substantial right to de novo review, to notice under 5104, without at least putting the veteran on notice and getting their input on it.
Thank you, Mr. Hoggis. So we're over time. Judge Falvey, do you have any questions? Okay. Judge Jagwith? But thank you, Mr. Hoggis. Counsel?
Your Honor, it may please the court. The court should affirm the decision on appeal and find that the board does not violate Section 7104A when adjudicating and denying entitlement to TDIU in the first instance. And the alternative, the court should find that appellant waived her right to initial AOJ decision in the matter. Given the choices that appellant made when appealing this in the AMA, the board was required to address evidence of unemployability in the first instance, and the board was required was only required to remand in order to remedy a duty to assist violation at the AOJ level. While appellant argues that under Bernard, the board was required to obtain a waiver if it could not grant this benefit in full, this argument ignores the decades that have followed Bernard, development both in case law and in statute. So for example, in Disabled American Veterans, the Federal Circuit noted that the board does not violate appellant's rights under 7104 when addressing law that the AOJ did not. The TDIU regulation here is simply not the law.
What about facts, though? I mean, Mr. Hawk has argued that, you know, addressing facts in the first instance sort of takes away someone's right to de novo review. I guess the review part of de novo review.
Yes, Your Honor. So there is no blanket prohibition on factual findings in the first instance. And Congress, when passing 7113, required the board to address evidence in the first instance. On appeal in the AMA system, the record is closed except for the evidence that appellant wishes to submit to the adjudicator directly. And the board, you know, the board has its reasons or basis requirement. It is required to address that evidence, make factual findings, and address applicable regulations. So there would be no violation there, Your Honor.
Can't that submission of evidence reveal a duty to assist shortcoming?
Your Honor, there currently is a pending panel that gets at this question. But in all cases, the focus is on the existence of an error at the AOJ level. Appellant here is not arguing that the AOJ erred in the initial consideration of her claim. So it is important to keep that in mind.
What's the, in that vein, I guess, what's the significance of the failure of the veterans law judge who authored the March 2023 board decision on appeal to note that the prior board member in December of 2021 relied on a November 2019 opinion from the veteran's longtime physician that as a result of his problems with hearing, the veteran had developed significant paranoia in that he couldn't hear what people were saying, so he thought they were talking badly about him, and both the veteran and the appellant described the veteran's hearing loss as a workplace problem, including leading to coworkers laughing at him, ridiculing him, resulting in frustration, anger, paranoia, embarrassment, and heartbreak when he couldn't work. What's the significance of that? Isn't that the kind of factual engagement that we'd expect from the regional office?
Yes, sir, Your Honor. So in December 2021, after the board granted entitlement to service connection, there was a rating decision that assessed the occupational and social impairment caused by this now service-connected acquired adjustment disorder. So the RO made factual findings regarding the level of occupational impairment, found that the level of occupational impairment was not total, Your Honor.
What's the basis for the board's determination that the veteran's psychiatric disorder would most impact him as it relates to forgetfulness? Is that a medical determination?
That's based on the evidence of record, Your Honor. So it's
what evidence is there in the record that compares the impact of the veteran's forgetfulness with his anger and paranoia? Doesn't the medical evidence focus on the veteran's frustration, anger, and paranoia? Is forgetfulness more impactful than anger and paranoia?
Your Honor, the board was making a judgment about the impact of the symptoms specifically on the workplace. And again, sort of, it's important to note that the rating and the measured occupational impairment here is not being challenged. The question is whether the board had jurisdiction over TDIU, not the merits of the TDIU decision itself.
It doesn't seem like there's any question about whether the board had jurisdiction over TDIU. The parties agree that it does.
Yes, Your Honor.
But that leaves the question of how that jurisdiction is exercised, right?
Yes, Your Honor. This court has long held, in Rice, Phillips, and other cases, that TDIU is part and parcel of a claim, both for an initial rating and an increased rating. And appellant's reliance on Bernard to suggest that the board had jurisdiction but no authority to deny entitlement to TDIU, ignores developments in case law and statute and the review options and evidentiary windows applicable in the AMA, Your Honor.
How is that inconsistent with the AMA?
Bernard, Your Honor?
Yes. And there's been a handful, maybe a half dozen even, of precedential court opinions since Bernard that have reaffirmed it.
Your Honor, so there are one precedential opinion by the Federal Circuit after Bernard is Disabled American Veterans, noting that the court can address law, in this case, the TDIU regulation in the first instance without violating rights to 7104. And it's important to note that the AMA...
This isn't principally a legal issue in this in the case we have before us. It's a factual one.
Yes, Your Honor. Also important to note that when passing the AMA, the court greatly limited the board's authority to remand, the remedy that Mr. Duakas is seeking. So the board is required only to remand, to remedy a duty to assist error, and another potential remand must involve a failure below. This is not the case in which new evidence can lead to the need for new factual development. It is not in the legacy system in which evidentiary development continued throughout the life of the claim. New evidence may have warranted the development of other evidence, which would have warranted a remand. But that's just not possible in the system that Congress created here, Your Honor.
Isn't it possible under the AMA and perhaps having occurred here that the board could have concluded that properly under 2802 and 5103A that there was a shortcoming in the AOJ's attention to reasonably raised TDIU claim or contention or part and parcel of the rating challenge?
The board could have, Your Honor, but that is discretionary. And again, appellant has not argued that there is an error below or identified an error below.
Well, what's not discretionary is, at least arguably not discretionary, certainly this is the appellant's argument that the board had a duty and obligation under Bernard that it failed to fulfill or even acknowledge.
No, Your Honor. So it's important to note that Bernard involved reopening a previously denied claim. So the initial, which that informs the decision of Bernard, Your Honor. So the initial Ring decision denied reopening the claim. It focused on whether evidence, met the required standard. And the Veterans Board hearing on appeal specifically discussed the standard for reopening a claim. It did not address the merits of the issue in that case, which was entitlement to service connection for multiple sclerosis. So here, the veteran, the claimant, she submitted the evidence she wished to submit. She and a representative both discussed this issue at the hearing. The board member presiding over the hearing identified TDIU as an issue on appeal. At the hearing, the appellant's representative asked the board to grant entitlement to TDIU. So unlike Bernard, in which the hearing and the initial rating decision were focused on a threshold matter, here the disability rating and whether a 100% rating was warranted what was always at issue, everyone had noticed, Your Honor.
Why shouldn't we echo Judge Bartley's 2019 Bakulis decision that nothing in an appellant's asking that the board grant TDIU waives their right to agency appellate review of an adverse TDIU determination?
Yes, Your Honor. Two important things to note. That is a memorandum decision, and also that the decision on appeal there predates the AMA and restrictions on the board's ability to remand. So again, it may be applicable somewhere. It's not applicable here, Your Honor.
I want to ask you, counsel, what happens when a veteran's a claimant submits evidence to the board in, along the lines of 7113, so timely, within 60 days or something. And it basically is evidence for a totally new claim, right? Not on appeal, not part of the NOD, not part of the original claim. So clearly outside the scope. What does VA do with those? Do they just ignore them or?
That may be a case in which referral is appropriate, Your Honor.
So sometimes they would refer them, but they have no statutory duty to adjudicate it.
Yes, Your Honor. Again, and then, TDIU is part and parcel of an appeal. That also happens, for example, when an upstream issue is on appeal and downstream issues need to be adjudicated later. So initially, the first time this was before the board, the appellant was challenging the denial of entitlement to service connection. The board granted service connection. The board had no authority to, in the first instance, assign a rating or an effective date. There are cases in which, again, there are issues raised that the board needs to send down to the AOJ.
What's the impact of fair process on whether the board's required to consider whether the appellant would be prejudiced by the board addressing an issue in the first instance?
Yes, Your Honor. So important to, when we're talking about fair process, it's important to clarify what we're talking about here, pursuant to the Federal Circuit's holding in Francis V. McDonough, and this court's holding in Bill Haar's fair process is a recognition that constitutional due process applies. And so that would be the Matthew v. Eldridge factors. There has been no due process requirement that Mr. in the shape of what Mr. Dukakis is arguing is required. This satisfies constitutional due process and is largely determined by the statutes and process that Congress has created. Again, it's important to note that Congress, in passing the AMA, has given appellants different options. There are three options for appealing a less than fully favorable board decision, fully favorable rating decision. Appellant first chose higher level review, and then chose to appeal to the board. Appellant did not choose a third option, a supplemental claim, which would have allowed her to present this evidence before the AOJ in the first instance. And so the board has no authority to reroute the claim. It is bound by the choices that a claimant makes.
I'd like to ask you a question about 7104. That 7104 is the board's statutory jurisdictional, it's the jurisdictional statute of the board. Is that something that's waivable? Then if that's a jurisdictional provision, is that something that's waivable?
Your Honor, rights under 7104 are waivable because the one appeal to the secretary is a claims processing rule, Your Honor.
Despite the fact that it's called the board's jurisdiction.
So the right to one review on appeal specifically is waivable, Your Honor. So there needs to be an initial decision by the regional office in order to confer jurisdiction on the board. Whether an issue is presented that should be remanded pursuant to 7104 is a waivable question, Your Honor.
I mean, certainly
the evidence of waiver here.
Sorry, Your Honor, can you repeat that?
That's the evidence of waiver here.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. So first, in the notice of disagreement, there's the cover letter of the notice of disagreement. Appellant's representative specifically requested that TDIU be considered as part and parcel of the appeal. In the board hearing, the veteran's representative asked the board to grant entitlement to TDIU. In a cover letter attached to the vocational assessment, the veterans representative again asked the board to consider that evidence in the first instance. So we have evidence of a waiver. If a right existed here, we have evidence of a waiver that was made knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently.
So back to Bakulis, you reject that decision's conclusion that seeking a grant of TDIU is not a waiver of the veteran's right to one review on appeal.
Your Honor, again, sort of we note that there is no right to be waived here, but if there were, yes, the. As the board, as 7113 states, the board is required to consider this evidence and the evidence and argument in the first instance. And the board's reasons or bases requirement requires it to address and make factual findings regarding all potentially applicable regulations. So once there is evidence that could suggest entitlement to TDIU, the board is required to adjudicate and make factual findings regarding whether appellant is entitled to a 100% rating under the regulation 4.16. So it's not a tenable distinction to argue that a claimant is waiving consideration of the evidence, but not waiving any rights regarding adjudication as well.
So would this be an accurate statement of the secretary's position that that the board can adjudicate in the first instance anything that falls within the scope of a claim that is on appeal, right? Short of maybe downstream issues like effective dates, assigning a rating, if the issue was service connection, right?
Yes, Your Honor. So basically, any as this court noted in Vargas Gonzalez v. Principi, you know, an NOD cannot express disagreement with an issue not decided. You know, and it's in a standard claim, right? Their disability compensation claim. There are three issues. You know, there are three issues here: service connection and effective date, disability rating. So if so, here only disability rating was on appeal. The board was required to address all questions within the scope of the disability rating. But for example, the effective date here was not on appeal.
Yeah, well, I mean, it strikes me the difference between the sides here comes down to the kind of the granularity, you know, by which we sort of deal with, is it facts, is it issues, is it claims, what's the kind of, what's the scope? The RO obviously does not have a reasons and basis requirement, right? So, you know, we know what the rulings are, but we would not know all the factors that in the record that they considered. But the statement of the case, right, is designed to kind of give some notice as to the factors that that the regional office considered, right?
Yes, in the legacy system, yes. But it's probably helpful to consider this as a, as the court has discussed, this is TDIU is a rating option. So if in a in an unrelated case, if the board assigns entitlement to a 30% rating based on a certain diagnostic code, on appeal, the appellant argues that the board, the rating, the RO applied the incorrect diagnostic code. And in fact, these symptoms warrant entitlement to a higher rating under a different code. The board is therefore required to address the applicability of that regulation in the first instance. Again, it would be untenable for the board to remand every time a veteran raises the applicability of a different diagnosis.
I mean, I'm looking at, I don't know if you've got the CFR in front of you. I'm looking at 20.802, right? Which
yes.
is, it seems like, you know, the secretary has is obligated to remand for correction of error, right? And so the first sentence of that looks like it's mandatory, shall remand for duty to assist violations. The second sentence looks like it's may remand for correction of any other error. So maybe that's discretionary, maybe, you know, but it's all predicated on error. Is there any authority to remand things merely kind of in the first instance, like absent a showing of error?
No, Your Honor. The focus is on error and specifically on focus in the initial adjudication. That is in large part the purpose of the AMA. A veteran has an ability to take evidence or arguments directly to the board, or a veteran may file a supplemental claim and present them first to the RO. The board cannot reroute the claim.
So it looks like Judge Falvey, do you have any more questions?
No, I don't.
Okay. Judge Jaquith, do you have any more questions?
No, I don't. Thanks.
Okay.
Then I will conclude, and the Secretary respectfully asks of the court from the decision on appeal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dacus.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I want to start with both Bernard and more importantly, Jarrell. Jarrell, page 331 of that decision, citing to 7104A, when a claim is properly appealed, the board is vested with the jurisdiction to review all questions in the matter. And then it continues at the beginning of page 333, once the board has jurisdiction, it has authority to address all issues related to that claim, even those not previously decided, citing Bernard. And then it says, to exercise this authority with regard to questions or issues not previously addressed by the RO in the first instance, however, the board must secure a waiver from a claimant or otherwise determine that there would be no prejudice to the claimant. So this, Jarrell was issued in 2006, Bernard in 1993. So for nearly 30 years, this had been the law. 2012, the Congress gave the board the authority to review evidence in the first instance unless the claimant asked for a remand for that purpose. So when Congress modified the statutes and implemented the AMA. It was aware of this case law. This is an en banc case from Jarrell and a panel from Bernard. That was the established law. Congress legislates.
Let me ask you, and I understand what you're saying, but I want to pose to you what I just posed to the Secretary's counsel, which is it's kind of about the scope of what is on appeal, right? And so it strikes me, I mean, you want it to be very granular, right? Which is pretty much any fact that hasn't been decided first by the RO. And the Secretary is arguing more, it's just the kind of the scope of a claim itself or any issue that's specifically cited on the NOD. If it's more granular, how would we ascertain what the RO has, in fact, looked at? You know, if you get down to the individual level, as opposed to like a theory of service connection, maybe, or, whether extra scheduler is warranted, some issue that could kind of be raised in the first instance. Would we assess it by looking at the SOC and saying anything that's outside the scope of the SOC would be deemed raised in the first instance by the board?
Certainly, it's very difficult when we're looking at facts, Your Honor. And in the legacy with the statement of the case and in the AMA with the 5104 notice, the statutes require detail. True in the legacy, the rating decision and even the AOJ does not have a reasons or bases requirement as the board does.
So has there ever been case law that linked the kind of board's adjudicatory capacity, let's call it, with have they delimited it by the contents of the SOC in the way that you're describing, which is to say to venture beyond the SOC in the first instance would be problematic? Is there anything, any case or anything you can think of that goes there?
Well, yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. Bernard. That was Bernard. The Secretary, I think, misreads Bernard to say that because they have jurisdiction, they can just go ahead and decide the questions. But Bernard actually remanded for the board to determine whether the veteran would be harmed, just as Bakulis did, whether there is harm. Bernard was the ultimate ruling was Bernard was a remand of that specific issue because the AOJ.
Wasn't Bernard, it adjudicated a claim on which an earlier kind of motion for new and material evidence had been denied, right? I mean, it was a claim that wasn't within the NOD. It's not just a matter of like going beyond the SOC to kind of address a new theory, right?
No, I don't think that's how Bernard understood the statute, Your Honor. And that's certainly not how Comer and some of the subsequent case law. The statute distinguishes between a matter and questions within the matter. The matter in Bernard was entitlement to benefits for that condition. And one of those questions was, at least in that procedural posture, whether new and material evidence had been submitted to reopen. The AOJ said no. The board said yes, but we're going to deny it. And the court said, once you got past yes, you had to either get a waiver, find the veteran is not harmed, or send it back for one.
Right, but that's because that would have been a claim. I guess if the NOD was just the procedural, right? That's what you're saying. It was they complained about the denial of the motion for new material evidence over and against adjudicating the substance of the claim itself.
Well, and the claim itself, Your Honor, and Witkowski actually touches on this some, which was issued just a couple of weeks ago, in that the claim construction itself, and DeHart also was a panel from last year, looks at what is the nature of a claim. And the claim itself is a request for those specific benefits. Here, it's benefits for the psychiatric condition. Once it's been granted, the rating now becomes the matter that was adjudicated by the VA. And DeHart in particular, and I don't necessarily subscribe to this, but at least for the purposes of this case, the facts are somewhat similar to DeHart's analysis of TDIU being different. And Rice and Comer and Roberson and all these cases recognize that TDIU is differently treated because it's a way of obtaining an appropriate rating. And so I don't think that the Secretary would dispute that if Mr. Mr. Allison was seeking or Mrs. Allison was seeking a different scheduler rating, whether, then it would be within the jurisdiction of this appeal. But for whatever reason, the secretary gets hung up on TDIU, but it's nothing special. It's just a rating. It's a regulation that allows the board to assign a specific rating outside of Part 4, well, outside of the diagnostic codes. So the issue or matter, as the statute calls it, is the appropriate rating, one question in there and one applicable or potentially applicable law is 4.16 in assigning a TDIU rating. Just to finish my thought, this case law existed when Congress amended the statutes. Congress didn't do anything to change 7104A. Had Congress wanted to remove this one review on appeal right, it would have done so. The fact that that 7113 was included, which allows initial review of evidence, is irrelevant because, again, in 2012, the board already had that right. All 7113 did was remove the right to ask for a remand for the evidence. And I would just point out that normally when new evidence is submitted, it typically would address or speak to the specific questions that were addressed by the AOJ in the decision. And so when it does that, then the board can consider that evidence and, to the extent within the confines of 7104A, make findings of fact, review the VA's decisions de novo, and determine what those facts are. But when they... when it addresses something different, as in here, TDIU, then a different analysis applies.
Mr. Hawkins, I see you're up against your time. You spent some of rebuttal answering my question. So do you want two more minutes to,
if you have any? I do, questions? Your Honor. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Well, great. Great. Two more minutes.
So the other aspect of the Secretary's argument is that by closing off the duty to assist somehow changed anything. Again, there's nothing in there that changes 7104A, or even speaks to the board's authority to consider questions in the matter that had not been subject to one review. The 20.802 was included to recognize bases for remand for errors by the AOJ. This was triggered in large degree because of the duty to assist restrictions. But again, there's nothing in any of the statutes that Congress meant to change the holding in Bernard, the holding in Jarrell, that interpreted the statute. This is a statutory interpretation. Had Congress wanted to change it, they would have done so. To the extent that they overlooked it, that's just how the statute is written right now. Last point on evidence of waiver, we would just reemphasize, as Judge Jaquith pointed out, Bakulis, although it was a legacy decision, The holding there is that the asking for a benefit is not the same as a waiver. And the secretary just points to giving evidence and asking for an adjudication that is not contemplated by any of the case law on waiver. We didn't get to that, but we would just ask you to consider our supplemental brief in finding that it's a very fact-heavy determination. And there was no fact-finding done by the board on whether anything had been waived. All that the board did was, at best, is implicitly found that there was a waiver, although more than likely I don't think they recognize that they should have considered waiver. So Mrs. Allison asked that this court recognize, one, that the TDIU question is within the matter of a rating for her husband's psych rating, that, two, the board did have jurisdiction to consider it, but, three, lacked authority absent a waiver or a finding of harmless error. We ask that it be remanded for the board to make those determinations on prejudice and waiver.
Great. Thank you, counsel. This case is submitted for consideration and adjourned.
Court is adjourned.